This is an ABC podcast.
Back in the 60s, the Country Women's Association of Australia was often the backbone of many regional and rural towns.
If you're a woman and you live in the country, chances are that you're kept pretty busy with the shopping, the family, the home, the garden, the many jobs that take up so much of a woman's time. But chances are, too, that you may be one of the 100,000 women in Australia who find time to take part in the many activities of the Country Women's Association.
It was another time. As you can imagine, in 2024, numbers are now slipping. But today, we're going to take you to Darkin, a tiny town in WA, where the youngsters are breathing new life into the CWA. And we find out the latest from Ballarat in the search for missing woman Samantha Murphy. I'm Sinead Mangan, and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Whadjuk Country, Perth. It's now been 17 days since 51-year-old mother of three, Samantha Murphy, left her Ballarat East home for her regular morning run and failed to return home. Her disappearance triggered a huge search effort from police, emergency services, volunteers and the Ballarat community. Victoria Police say the investigation and search for Miss Murphy is ongoing, but at this stage have released no leads and there's been no trace of Miss Murphy. Now, 2.5 weeks on, the community search is ramping up again. Rochelle Kirkham is our reporter in Ballarat and she joins me now. Now, Rochelle, what's the community there in Ballarat doing to find or to help find Samantha Murphy?
Sinead, community members are really ramping up their efforts in this search for missing woman Samantha Murphy around Ballarat at the moment. Things have become a little bit quiet because there's been a lack of new information from police in what's happening with the investigation. There was a massive community search effort in those first few weeks, which seemed to die down a little bit. But now people who have continued to stay out there in the areas around Ballarat where Miss Murphy was known to run, who have been continuing that search and are really trying to ramp up that effort and get more community members back out. They're putting a big call out for members of the public to join a public search this week and particularly a mass search effort on Saturday. So they just don't want to give up and they don't want this story to be forgotten.
What's the expectation in terms of turnout for that community search?
I did speak to a community member who's part of organising the search this afternoon, and at this stage she said it's still really unknown. Look, there have been hundreds of people who have been involved over the past few weeks, so at this stage they don't really know what to expect. It could be in the dozens, it could be in the hundreds.
I understand there's help coming from well outside of Ballarat because you've spoken to a man from New South Wales who's come down, Jake Casser. Why did he want to get involved?
I did speak to Jake this afternoon. He just arrived in Ballarat this afternoon from New South Wales, and he's a bushcraft teacher and tracker who has been involved in other missing persons community searches, including he spent 2 weeks looking for missing boy William Tyrrell. So I guess he's been following this case as well in the past few weeks and has been actually talking to some of those community members who were trying to ramp up the search this week. And they've supported him and encouraged him to come down and help join the search effort. There's been broad support for that. I was told someone in the US who's been following the case donated funds to bring Jake down to Ballarat to pay for his flights. And I spoke to him this afternoon a little bit about what he'll be doing over the next couple of days around Ballarat.
I'm going to do my best to pretty much leave no stone unturned. I'm going to go into all the remote areas and I'll cover a fair bit of ground in 12 or 15 hours a day. And I'll probably spend some of the time throughout the night out there as well. But my other objective is to, you know, help give some survival, some tracking tips to some of the locals here that might help them in their searches, and I'll continue to liaise with them even when I go back home.
That's Jake Casser, who's a bushcraft teacher and tracker from New South Wales, and he's come down to Ballarat to help in the search for missing woman Samantha Murphy. Now, it just shows the level of feeling and that, you know, that people are really throwing their might into this. For yourself, Rochelle, living in Ballarat, what has this situation been like? Because it's 2.5 weeks now. What's the feeling like?
It has been a really difficult thing for the community to grasp, really, because there's so many uncertainties with what's happened here. All we know is that Miss Murphy had intended to leave home on the 4th of February in the morning for her regular run, something she'd do quite often. And all police know is that she left her home and there's been no trace of her since. So that uncertainty has been really hard for the community to grapple with, particularly people who can relate to Miss Murphy's situation. You know, people who do the same thing every day, go for their run, maybe in the bushland too, where she runs. A lot of people have felt deterred from doing that because of a new fear. I've spoke to some women who say that they don't feel safe anymore to run in the bush by themselves. So they're some of the things that are still continuing to plague the community here.
Rochelle, are you finding people are changing their behaviour?
We have heard reports that people are changing their behaviour. They're thinking differently about how they go out by themselves. Some are not going out by themselves. We're hearing more people are running in groups or perhaps joining some running groups in the town just to feel that sense of comfort with other people. We've also heard about people, you know, taking their dogs when they usually wouldn't, or looking at how they can implement some safety methods, like, you know, telling their partner where they're running and when they're expected to be home, just triggered to do these things from Miss Murphy's disappearance.
The other thing about this is that there's a vacuum of information, which is unnerving unto itself. What information are the police providing? Have they given any updates lately?
At this stage, we've really not heard much from the police. They've been very tight-lipped about what's been happening with the investigation and search, particularly in the past week, week and a half. We did hear, not last weekend, the one before, about a week after Miss Murphy's disappearance, police said they were scaling down the search and focusing on other parts of the investigation, including establishing the circumstances and Miss Murphy's movements leading up to that morning where she left for her run. And really, we haven't heard much since, other than the police commissioner coming out and saying it was a very unusual case. He did use the term suspicious, but that was cleared up, that when the police are not officially treating the case as suspicious. He just said it's very unusual, suspicious circumstances, that there's been no information or evidence that's been found, as far as we know so far, that has assisted the police investigation.
Rochelle, what about the police presence? Can you still see police around? Is it very evident?
In the early days, it was very evident. We saw a lot of police out searching, a lot of police cars on the route between the areas that were the search focuses. I would say there has not been a lot of visible police presence, not like those early days, and not since the search was scaled back. We will still seek information on what the police are doing. It's understood they're focusing on other investigative parts of the search and investigation, but we are hearing from police that they won't speak further or give any updates until there's significant developments in the case.
Now, obviously, the ABC office in Ballarat are keeping a close eye on things, and you've been talking to people who've, you know, who have experience in this area. Lauren O'Keefe was one of those from the MIST Foundation, and her brother went missing 12 years ago, and she now works with people whose loved ones have gone missing. What advice did she offer for those searching for Samantha? What did she tell you?
Lauren has a lot of experience in working with the families of long-term missing people, and she, of course, has been following this case closely as well. And something that she really emphasised is that speculation and theories from members of the public are really unhelpful during this process, can be really hurtful to the family as well. And unfortunately, it's something that we've seen, particularly on social media, since Miss Murphy's disappearance. There was a Find Samantha Murphy page that was intended for people who are out searching to connect and share information of where they've been searching, but it did fill with wild speculations and theories that eventually understand that page was asked to be shut down because of that. So Lauren did emphasise for people in the community not to speculate. She did encourage people to access a free online masterclass from the MIST Foundation about ambiguous loss, and that's this term that's used to describe the grief associated with a missing person, you know, missing someone and not knowing, that uncertainty of not knowing what's happened. And she encouraged anyone, you know, regular people, whether or not they're connected to the Murphy family or not, to gain a better understanding of what it's like to experience ambiguous loss, just to aid themselves in, you know, not judging the family and not speculating in this case, but doing something useful that can help them understand the situation. And even, you know, if people are not connected to the Murphy family, they may also be experiencing this sense of grief and loss, because it is a tight-knit community here. And she did emphasise that research shows at least 12 people are adversely impacted when one person goes missing. But here in Ballarat, I think she said it's a very conservative number, because the whole community here seems to be hurting. But she did say people should try and stay united and as positive as possible.
Rochelle Kirkham in Ballarat, thanks for talking to Australia Wide.
Thanks, Sinead.
You're listening to ABC Australia Wide.
In Queensland, it's hoped that spending time on country in remote communities could help young First Nations people from ending up in the juvenile detention system. The government has announced a trial program that would work with young people identified as being at risk of offending and relocating them to remote areas to undertake programs aimed at breaking the cycle of criminal behaviour. Our reporter in Mount Isa, Emily Dobson, has been following this story and she joins me now. Now, Emily, what did the government announce today and what is the program and how talk me through how it would work?
So the Premier was in Townsville earlier this morning to announce an extension of a program that would see serious offenders, repeat offenders at that, head to remote locations in a bid to address the state's youth crime issues and take some pressure off the juvenile detention system. Now, this isn't mandatory. It's very much a voluntary program and an extension on the on-country program that had already been running for a few years. Di Farmer, the Minister for Education and Minister for Youth Justice, also spoke at the presser this morning, and she explained that it's not a relocation sentence. It's for voluntary participants that would be referred by caseworkers, schools, Queensland Police, a range of other groups. But it is all about that opting in and hoping to tackle the root cause of a crime rather than a punishment for a crime that's been committed.
Now, Emily, would there be regional communities that would be keen to volunteer their area as potential locations for these programs for young people deemed at risk?
Absolutely. And a lot of communities already run non-government funded programs, I would say, but on-country programs of such in their own communities. So there's definitely a scope for this. One of the communities that have come forward before this announcement was made was Mornington Island leader Kyle Yanner, suggesting that the Wellesley Islands in Queensland's Gulf of Carpentaria would be a pretty appropriate location for program delivery.
So we've got, you know, we've got cattle pass, you know, cattle leases over in Doomadgee, you know, where heaps of cattle where we can train kids up to work, you know, on stations and stuff. Work with horses, you know, it's quite therapeutic to work with horses. But not only that, like, so Mornington Island in particular, we're in discussions now. We're trying to formulate a meeting with our Kaidult neighbours. So the reason for that is Kaidult, the Kaidult clan group, they have a beautiful island called Bentinck Island. And I think the reasons to get kids out of towns where the trouble is a no-brainer. First, you remove the problem. You know, the problem of the kids, if they're out of town, the crime goes, nothing's happening in town, it's going to be quiet. But beneficial to removing the kids from the town, you put them in a nice, beautiful, peaceful place, pristine place, away from any temptations, you know. Put them in a spot where you can love and nurture them through, you know, their problems and instill programs.
That's Kyle Yanner, who is a leader at Mornington Island. Now, Emily, this isn't a first. There has been similar programs in the Northern Territory. How do they go?
That's right. I spoke with former Youth Justice Program Manager Carl Howard earlier this week. He's an Indigenous man from Mount Isa in Queensland, but he's got over 15 years' experience in delivering and consulting in the construction of some of these programs in the Northern Territory, including government-funded mandatory programs, which in his opinion is what is needed to see these hard results. Now, while that might not be what is been announced today, what has been announced is similar to some of the work that Carl's undertaken. So it's going to be taking these young offenders aged between 10 and 17 years to a remote location where they're able to work with elders and traditional owners as part of a cultural intervention.
Yeah, we've certainly seen, and the statistics show that incarceration is costly to the government and to taxpayers. Recidivism is very high, not only in the Territory but in Queensland, as I've seen some of the statistics. But, yeah, just the programs that are on country, working with local people, then in turn breaking that cycle of being institutionalised, I suppose.
That's Carl Howard speaking about the experience in Northern Territory. Now, Emily, Queensland is heading into a state election this year, and particularly you're in a particularly interesting seat being in Mount Isa, but how big an issue is crime, and particularly youth crime, expected to be with the state election?
Yeah, there's no way of underselling that youth crime particularly is huge in every corner of Queensland. There's almost no town that isn't experiencing it or hasn't experienced it in the past few years at least. But there's nothing that can be said. The government of the day is attempting to curb the rate of youth crime as best they can. They've announced many initiatives over the past few years, including deploying youth co-responder teams across the state, including to places like Townsville, Cairns and Mount Isa, where they're seeing the highest rate of offending. Intensive bail initiatives were also recently expanded to Mount Isa, even down to assisting with cars that were being stolen, a major issue right across the state, and helping install devices in the cars with certificates so that residents in these most problem areas are able to protect themselves a little bit more. So there are definitely initiatives in place currently to help curb this rate. But one of the things that the Premier, Stephen Miles, mentioned this morning at that press conference is that there isn't a silver bullet to solving crime in the state. They're doing the best that they can by introducing as many initiatives in the lead up to this election as possible, but it definitely will be a huge issue to be made note of by October when that election is expected to occur.
Sounds like it will be. Emily Dobson in Mount Isa, thanks for talking to Australia Wide.
Thank you very much.
This is ABC Australia Wide.
During the Black Summer bushfires, towns along the Princes Highway in southeast New South Wales were completely cut off. Road closures prevented visitors leaving the area and essential resources like food and fuel from entering. Now, Transport for New South Wales hopes a new program will prevent situations like that ever happening again. James Tugwell has this story for us.
When the Black Summer bushfires tore through towns along the New South Wales south coast, Jan Main remembers wondering if Batemans Bay had been left to burn.
I remember that day like it was yesterday. I walked over to the supermarket to get some things about 8 o'clock in the morning, and the sky then was already black and purple and the wind was blowing. You knew that it was going to be a bad day. You just knew. You could feel it.
Residents with infant children and pets were arriving on the doorstep of the Batemans Bay Hotel where Miss Main is assistant manager, all desperate for help and with nowhere else to go. The King's Highway connecting Batemans Bay to Canberra had been closed for several weeks and supermarket shelves were bare after panic buying. The queue for petrol stretched kilometres down the Princes Highway, which was sporadically blocked to the north and the south.
And when it became apparent that north and south were blocked as well, and we were locked in here, and that's what it felt like, locked in, then you begin to feel isolated. And I felt, does anyone know that the south coast is burning? Is anyone going to come and help us? That's what I thought. I thought, can someone come and help us?
The New South Wales government has announced a 2-year pilot program designed to keep key regional roads open during future emergencies. 4 sites across New South Wales will be a part of the program, where cultural burns, such as this one on Yuin Country near Batemans Bay, will be conducted on native title land beside key highways to reduce fire risk. The trial sites will be alongside the Bruxner Highway near Grafton, the Oxley and Newell Highways near Coonabarabran, and the Princes Highway near Batemans Bay and Bega. Transport for New South Wales Network and Assets Executive Director Tom Graskoff says the pilot initiative is in response to recommendations from the New South Wales Bushfire Inquiry to grow cultural burning practices as a land management strategy and can be rolled out across the state.
Transport is the lifeblood of our communities. It's the way that we move ourselves and goods to backwards and forwards between people. And in times when things get dangerous, when it gets tough, whether that's in bushfire or flood, we rely on these networks to keep people safe. Resilience is not an easy thing to measure, and often you don't know how big an impact you've had because you don't have the alternative case. The key here is to manage the landscape in a way that it is designed to work. We see this as a response to a long period of ignoring the signals that nature has been giving us about the way that this landscape is working.
Batemans Bay Local Aboriginal Land Council CEO Roz Courage has been working to promote traditional burning for a long time as a means of safety, maintaining culture and looking after country. And she has seen an increase in support for cultural burning since the Black Summer bushfires.
We're doing our part in proving to people that it needs to be done, and it needs to be done in a big way, and it's good for the country, good for the community, and a hell of a lot better than the hot burns that we've been doing, because what's been happening in the past has not worked at all.
She says slow cultural burns are different to hazard reduction burns because they are multiple small spot fires creating a mosaic burnt pattern across the landscape, which is slow moving and less hot. She says the burns reduce the fuel load and therefore the ferocity of future bushfires along these key highways, while also helping reintroduce endemic native species.
It's very empowering for our community that we're able to do something, and it's not just a myth. People can see now that we looked after the country for the last 60,000 years and we still can. And we're just asking you to accept it and let us do our thing. And that's, it's just going to be the norm for future.
Batemans Bay Local Aboriginal Land Council CEO Roz Courage, and she was chatting there to our reporter James Tugwell. The Country Women's Association, or CWA as it's often known, is often the backbone of regional communities, and those propping it up are usually the female stalwarts of the town. But with farms getting bigger, some local CWA branches have been in danger of folding due to low membership numbers. That was certainly the case for one branch a few hundred kilometres south of Perth until one young determined member decided to do something about it. I think the CWA is an important part of our community and always has been, and so iconic, and it would be really sad to see it go.
3 years ago, the Country Women's Association in the West Australian wheatbelt town of Darkin was on the cusp of closing. That was until Bonnie Teffler came along.
There were four members. They couldn't continue due to health reasons. So they put out in our local paper they needed more members, otherwise the CWA in Darkin was going to close. So I saw that in the paper, and Mum and I messaged everyone that we knew in town that thought we'd be able to help, and everybody came down to the CWA building, and yeah, then we took it over from there.
The 23-year-old may not seem like your typical CWA deputy president, but her modern approach has attracted more than one-third of the townswomen to the historic association.
We're not as traditional as other branches, so we've done lots of amazing things. Workshops, we do a cake stall for Anzac Day usually, which attracts lots of people. We have our big International Women's Day event, which we held for the first time last year and was a huge success. So we've got that coming up again on the 6th of March. This year with guest speakers, everyone gets to dress up, beautiful food and venue. It's also just a chance for women to get together and just be themselves. Like, they don't have to be the mother or the teacher, whoever they are in the community. We can just come together and get to know other people. Like, I've become close with people that I wouldn't normally be close with if it wasn't for the CWA, so I think it's been really good.
One of those women is Darkin's primary school principal and new branch president, Eloisa Goss.
For us, it's all about fun and friendship and bringing women together, particularly rural women, and giving them an opportunity to come together in our meetings where we'll have dinner and maybe some drinks, have lots of conversations and support everybody. We're trying to attract younger members, and particularly young mums, so that they can learn from maybe some of the older women in our community, and they can rely on those women for support, because particularly women in regional areas, a lot of them have married into the farming community, so they're not going to have their support network, their own personal family close to them. So we've got a couple of members who have got little babies, and for them, their parents are either interstate or in the metro area, and so they've been able to connect with some older women who have already had children and then provide them with some support.
Great buzz about the place. Dark and CWA President Louisa Goss ending that story from our reporter Andrew Chounding. And that is Australia-wide for this Wednesday. I'm Sinead Mangan. I hope you're having a lovely evening. Cheerio.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.